Here I am with Ponso and Dupi, and we'll be talking about the rehearsal process for Monrovia. I just want to talk about now how you feel in general about the project, Ponso.
Personally, I'm very excited about this project. I feel like it's going to be very, very impactful. It's going to make a big, it's going to start a very big conversation that's going to be very necessary in our time right now. I think it's beautiful that we're starting it like from scratch again, you know, in as much as we're going back from the roots of like the previous script, but it's like the story has grown way, way further than what we could ever thought. So that's like really what I'm excited about. And of course, I'm excited to be part of the writing. So,
well, let's just get one thing perfectly clear. I am the writer, okay? So if you change any of my words, there's going to be trouble. No, I'm joking, of course. That's not the way it's going to go. It's going to be a completely democratic process because we're building this from scratch. It's a way of dramaturgy. It's called dramaturgy, where we build plays from individual experiences and individual emotions that turn into character. Because let's talk about those emotions now. One of the characters is Grace.
Yes.
And she's at the end of her tether. She's a prostitute living in Monrovia. And I want you to talk about that character and tell us what you think that character can go and what her emotional state of mind is.
I think Grace is a great representation of Africa being stripped naked. It goes back to the situation of just Grace is a hustler and she's trying her best to keep her spirit going, to keep the narrative going. But at the end of the day, Grace has been used and abused and taken up and down. So I feel like it's a good representation of like Liberia, the dynamic of like, okay, this is your land, but it's not your land. Do you know what I mean? Like the prostitute can represent a sense of like, you know, this is your body, but it's not your body because we're going to use it for a service. And then when we're done with it, we're going to throw it away until it profits us best. So I think that could be a narrative. And I think a really good narrative as well of Grace could be to kind of expose like the depth of like of how politically messy Liberia is, and even just a concept of freedom. Like it's not really as, you know, like we hear a lot in our generation, you know, you own your body, own your body, own your body. But at the same time, people would still judge a woman who is a prostitute or is a sex worker. So it's the same thing as like, okay, freedom, freedom, freedom. As a nation, we're free, we're free, we're free. But then it's like you're really not as free because you don't have your land, you don't own your resources, you're still underneath the mental slavery of your previous master. So are you free or are you not free? Like that could be a narrative. I don't know about you, Dr. Matt Hawkins.
It's you. Called me a doctor, and I guess I am a doctor of philosophy. Yeah. I'm not a medical doctor, just so that that's known. Yes, but looking at that character of Grace, how does she then fight back? Does she fight back? And what is the fight? What has she got to win?
I think it goes back to the whole ownership thing, you know. Like, ever since when we look at Africa as a continent, before people say it's a country, when you look at Africa as a continent, you see it as different struggles that have happened, but it's not like the African people ever just sat down and let the struggle happen to them. Do you know what I mean? It was a matter of like, okay, they had all these struggles, but they were still fighting for the freedom. Even though they were going through the struggles, they're still fighting for it. So it's the same thing as Grace. It's like she's still trying to fight for her freedom and for her ability to kind of live the freedom, the life and the truth that she wants to live. But the general society is still systematically, you know, imprisoned mentality-wise. So that then doesn't give her the liberty to be like, this is what I want, which is when you look at it from African perspective of politically, there's so many times when you're like, African countries are like, yeah, we're going to get back our land. You know, let's talk about it from Julius Malema's perspective. We're going to get back our land. We're going to get back our resources. That's us fighting, fighting, fighting. But the land is not ours. Like, in as much as we want it to be ours, we don't own it anymore. So it's like, it's a continuous struggle of like, is this going back or is it not going back?
It's interesting. Once you gain that liberation, once you get that liberty, what do you do with it? Mm-hmm. What does it become?
Exactly.
You say we don't own the land anymore. Mm-hmm. Who owns land at all, anywhere. What do we own? And what is ownership? I think this project goes into the depths of that, the artifice of things like nationhood and ownership of land. But it seems so important to everyone. But in fact, it's a falsehood that we actually own anything at all. So how do we reconcile that in Africa?
I feel like in Africa, it's just, you know, all right, I'm not going to disrespect the Aboriginal culture. I was going to give it in the sense of, you know, Australia is different because Aboriginal culture, you know, when the land was taken from them through the stolen generation, but it wasn't just the land, it was a whole generation of people and their culture and their truths and all this stuff. So, but when this the government said sorry, and I say that in inverted commas, when the government said sorry, it was a thing of, okay, we're going to acknowledge you at ceremonies now. We want to acknowledge that we're on the Ghana land, you know, things like that. That's, I think, a way that Africa can go, you know, like resources-wise, Aboriginal people are put at priority now. Do you know what I mean? Like they have their own form of priority in this land that they were first, like the first owners. So, and I think also when you think about it, like how you said, it's kind of a falsehood of like ownership, because let's look at Europe, right? Europeans literally took over the whole world. And even in them taking over, if they didn't take over the world by actually taking land, their culture went into a different country and like took over, you know, and that's how we live in the modern world. So it's like, are we going to be, I mean, we can't always be mad at Europeans, but it's like, are we going to be, who owns what anymore? Do you know what I mean? But I think the problem with Africa is that even till this day, the resources of the land, the people who are on the land, the people who are toiling that land are still not being fed from that land. So the ownership goes to a more of like, let's take care of the people who are actually whose ancestors have been here for generations on generations, and let's make this same soil that the ancestors bled on, let's make that soil benefit them, instead of let's continuously take from them. We've already stolen from them anyway, we might as well continue. And I feel like that's the narrative that often happens. It's like, no, Africa's always been like this, so what do we expect? Or it's like, we will never learn. And it's like, if we keep up that narrative of, oh, we will never learn, that means we're saying we don't want to learn, we don't want better, we don't want to actually make the necessary changes that are necessary. Do you know what I mean? So I feel like from that regard.
It's learning is an interesting thing. It is actually educating. The great Fela Kuti once wrote a song called Teacher, Don't Teach Me Nonsense. Uh-huh. And so that's where the powers that be seek to instruct us in the righteous way of living. Yeah. But where that becomes very confusing, I think, is once you work that out, do you then turn around and start oppressing other people, which is the interesting experiment of Liberia.
Thank you. See, that reminds me, that's one thing that I always said. I feel like a lot of people say, and this is also for people who are underprivileged, or people, let me say, who have a past slave mentality, right? So a lot of people say, oh, you know, we want freedom, we want this, we want this. And this is what a lot of African nations did. We want freedom, we want freedom, we get our freedom. But we didn't want freedom, we wanted privilege. Do you get what I mean? So we wanted to feel, because what happens, a lot of people don't understand, is that when you put a system of oppression on people, the people that are oppressed start to steal to get amongst each other. They start to, you know, they're trying to get themselves to feel a certain level of superiority amongst their oppression. Do you know what I mean? It's like the whole master's house thing. Like, you know, the slave, that the house slave and the outside slave. So the outside slave feels like they're not that great because they live outside. But then the one inside thinks like they're better because they live in the house. But it's like, you're still a slave, so you still have no power. You just made to feel like you have power. So it's the same thing with a lot of African nations. It's the same narrative that happened, which was a thing of like, okay, we want to, you know, we want to get the freedom. Once we get it, now we're like trying to make other people feel lesser than. It's like, oh, sorry, we have the power, you don't. You know what I mean? And it's the reason, it's the hunger. You know, poverty makes people savages. Like, it doesn't help, because now it's like, once you get the power, you're going crazy. And that's why I was like, and people are going to hate me for saying this, not like I'm not saying our freedom fighters didn't give us power. I mean, they didn't give us freedom. You know, always people don't hate on me about Mandela. But I feel like freedom got to our heads, you know, just the ideology of like, oh, we're no longer being hit anymore. Oh, we're no longer being going through this. So it's like, oh, yeah, 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 life is great. Kumbaya, my Lord. Let's all come together. But it's like, no, you didn't help me. Because I'm still enslaved. I still feel like I need to impress the white man for me to be feeling like I'm good in my own country. Do you get what I mean? I still don't have access to education at liberty as other people would do. So it's like the system is still in place. It's just that the puppets are different now. Do you know what I mean? The puppets are our own people now. It's like you have literally used masses' tools to enslave yourself. You know what I mean?
You referred to various leaders as puppets, and I think that's an interesting description of them. So, and they are, but who are they puppets of? Who is pulling the strings of these people?
I feel like they're puppets to the system. They're puppets to the system. They're puppets to the feeling of power. You know, when somebody, that's why bullies turn into people who are bullied turn into bullies. Do you know what I mean? A bully is mad because they never had the power someplace in their life. So now they have to infiltrate that power in a different place when they feel that they have the power. Do you know what I mean? It's an insecurity thing. So a lot of puppets, politicians have, and leaders have come to a point where they never had the power. So the fact that they, even in their mind, they're like, wait a minute, I can have a billion in my account and nobody know. Nah, bruh, these people need to know. They need to feel the wrath of me and my money and my resources. And they need to know that my family is the one, you know. So now it's like, instead of, hey, let's all help each other. And that's one thing that Africans, poverty did to Africa and slavery did to Africa. It stripped us of like the ability to help each other build. Do you get what I mean? So the reason European nations, Asian nations, even Indian nations are successful is because they work together. Do you know what I mean? In Australia, the government system is set up so that everybody can win. Do you get what I mean? Like, I can't be mad at my friend for buying a car because I can also go to work and probably find the same job. And also, do you know what I mean? In as much as like, yes, there's a systematic injustices here and there, but because of the way it was set up, the Europeans set it up in a way that it was beneficial for them and everybody around them. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't about just one family being on top and then everybody else being at the bottom and being at the pits. It was like, okay, it's all of us. Do you know what I mean? We're going to build nations for all of us. We're going to create work for all of us, our kids. So that's how generational wealth is brought up. But with Africans, it's a thing of like, oh, yeah, we want money. We want money. We want to take care of our immediate family. We want to take care of the people that are close to us. But at the same time, we're not trying to make Susie or Dora down the street also have a job. Do you know what I mean? Because we want to feel like, yeah, we're the ones who have made it. We have something different. It's just like when African people get excited when people say to them, oh, or when white people say to an African person, oh, you're not like the other ones. And then they get impressed. Why are you impressed? They're telling you you're a house slave. You're busy getting impressed. Oh, yes, I'm not like the other one. I'm special. We like to feel special too much. It's stupid. Stop feeling special. It's unnecessary. It's not. Stop it. Stop. You know, that's just my opinion on that.
Well, just briefly in defense of the African political system as it existed before colonial penetration, it did have a sense of a small community.
Exactly.
So one protected the small community. Not that there weren't, you know, more advanced socioeconomic systems. I mean, there was Great Zimbabwe, there was the Benin Empire, there was the Ghana Empire, there were many empires and many complex systems of power and economics. But often the idea of corruption is simply another way of the distribution of wealth.
Yes.
That Europeans, of course, they're not corrupt. They've just killed everyone else and taken all their money. And therefore, they can afford to be benevolent and generous, and which is, I think, referring to the character of Mr. Clay, who hopefully will sort of grow in this show. Mr. Clay is the benevolent Quaker landowner who's decided to do the right thing. bar the coloured people. Mm-hmm. But because he's got those resources, he can, because he stole and enslaved, then had a change of heart and decided, oh, well, maybe I will help these people, which is a kind of like liberalism.
Mm-hmm. It's the system. It's the system on system battle. Do you know what I mean? Because before European settlers came into Africa, we had our own communities, we had our own nations, we had our own way of rule of law. Do you get what I mean? We had our own stories, we had our own gods, we had our own cultures, we had our own languages, we had our own ways of ceremonies and marriages. Do you know what I mean? Even like South Africa, we have countries in South Africa itself. We have so many different cultures, and another culture has different ways of doing marriage than another culture. Do you get what I mean? So we were rich in our own regard. However, we cannot erase the fact that we went through a struggle as people, right? So we have been affected, like you said, we've been terrorized. We have been affected by trauma, and we are traumatized. We've been having trauma for many generations. So when trauma is not dealt with properly, and how you deal with trauma is you realize and you identify where the trauma began, right? So when we start to identify in which ways we were enslaved, we start to now work towards healing. But when you don't do that and you try to overcome your trauma and pretend that everything is great, kumbaya, my lord, next minute you are 3-4 generations into freedom and now you have PTSD because you've made the whole country broke because now you didn't know how to deal with power. Do you get what I mean? So it's a thing of we have to understand that as Africans, our innate self is to be in community. Our innate self is to help one another. Our innate self is to actually build each other up. But the system has robbed us of feeling that we should do that, because now we have to feel like I have to be the special one to be able to get on top. And that's where the problem comes. It's like, why do I need to savage and become a scavenger towards my brothers and sisters just to feel like I'm special, like than other people? Do you know what I mean? And that's what's happened for many generations. It's a thing of we've gotten our resources, we haven't gotten our resources, but we've gotten power, you know. But now when we've got the power, we're not distributing the power equally. So now what's happening is, even though, like, for example, if the power started, systems were put into place, right, that were going to be beneficial for years later, it doesn't matter if you're rich now or not. Do you know what I mean? It's about your kids' kids and their kids' kids and their kids' kids' kids being rich. Not just your kids' kids only, but other people's kids' kids. Do you know what I mean? Because when you were fighting through the struggle, you weren't by yourself. It wasn't just you and your family who was fighting the struggle. It was a whole nation of people fighting the same thing. So now that you're in power, how do you feel like you're supposed to be the only one who gets silk sheets in bed and eats croissants? And when other people are still eating maize meal in the morning and they can barely even afford water nor electricity, were you not with them in the struggle? Were you not protesting with them? Were you not out here chanting with them? You were. So now why are you eating? You eating at the king's table, and now you want other people to keep eating the crumbs? Just please make it make sense. Doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand.
That's corruption, isn't it? It's corruption. We're going to take a short break and hear a message from our sponsors. Be back with you right after this. Okay, we're back. And now we're going to talk about journeys that we take as a people, as a person, coming from very various different places. Ponso, tell me about the journey that you've been on.
Well, my journey, I came to Australia when I was 9. And before I came here, I lived a pretty normal life in Australia, and I mean South Africa. So I think when I first came to Australia, being the African kid, it was very different. It felt different for other people, but it didn't feel different for me, if that makes sense. Because, I mean, it felt different because I was the only black child at the school, and I went to a country town. So I came straight and I went to Wyala. And it was very weird. It was fun to be the new kid. But then afterwards, I started to realize I was an experiment. So I was more of like, oh, I want to touch your hair, sing for us, or, you know, oh, you can dance, oh, teach us how to do that, or, oh, what are you eating? That smells weird, like, you know. So it was a bit like, it wasn't weird. It was more odd for me that people found, and I could speak English as well. So everybody found it weird, like, oh, how do you know how to speak English? And I was like, because I went to an English school in South Africa. And he's like, oh, really? So you guys speak, you have houses? And I'm like, yes, we have houses, we have cars, we have roads, we have normal streets. Oh, really? Like, we thought you live in huts and, you know, oh, I thought you have a giraffe as an animal, you know. So I, at some point after doing the many shifts, because I've been to 7 schools in my whole life, so I had to do the back and forth of like learning how to be the African in the new space. And then I moved schools and it was a whole new thing again. It was like, this is in primary especially, so it was trying to be the trying to be black enough for the black kids, but also trying to be like white enough for the white kids, you know. But it was like hard because regardless of whatever I did, I just was the African kid. So it was like there were other black people, you know, there were Aboriginal people, but it was like, you're not our black. So I kind of felt that like segregation type of vibe from that. And then I went back to South Africa, and going back to South Africa was a bigger shock for me because I was finally excited to be home. You know, I was excited to see my people. I was excited to make friends. But then I come back and I have an accent. So it's like, oh, you speak funny. And the thing is, they're starting to make it a thing of like, you're making it up. It's like I was talking, like I was pretending this was not my real voice or my accent. So it was like, oh no, she's definitely like, she says she's from Australia, but I know she comes from Cape Town, or like I know she's been in Durban, she's just lying to us. And then I come also with a very like more Australian attitude, because there's nobody, like when I was in South Africa, there was people all the time in the streets when I was a kid. So I was a kid that used to play with my friends all the time. I come to Australia, there's no one in the streets. So I have to become the kid that's like kind of staying indoors, even though I like to go outside a lot. And then I go to South Africa and now I have a more Australian approach towards things. You know, I'm not as aggressive because like I remember people feeling like I was too nice, you know, and it was like, okay, so you're not hood enough. And it was like, okay, so now I'm like, what the hell am I doing? So I stayed in South Africa for like 3 years, which I loved because in the space of 3 years, I learned Zulu. Like I could speak Zulu fluently. And I used to be able to speak Zulu before. I mean, I speak Sotho. That's my mother tongue. I speak, I understand Xhosa. Like I can speak it a bit, bits in here. But Zulu, I could hear it as a kid and I could speak back, but it was never like fluently. So I went back and I got cultured. I lived in like, I wouldn't say the hood. I lived like in the burbs, but in the hood, you know? And then after that, I lived in the burbs. And then I went back also to like another. So it was like I was getting recultured, which felt amazing all over again. And then I came back to Australia. And guess what do I come to? To another smaller country town. And now I'm more flavored than I was when I first came here. So I come back and it's worse. It's worse than when I was a child. But now the problem that a lot of people were having in this country town was that I just didn't care. So for them, it seemed like I was being rude. So like, you know, usually when somebody comes into town or into a new town, especially a country town, the person is kind of sussed out by people. And then they have to decide if they're letting you in or they're not letting you in into the circle. And I think for me, it was like they expected that I would try and work or try and earn my way into their circles. But excuse me, I had no intention of doing that. I came with a thug life chose me attitude, which was like, you want to be my friend, you want to be my friend. If you don't want to be my friend, you don't want to be my friend. Like, if you don't, you want to chill with me, you chill with me. If you don't want to chill with me, don't chill with me. And I also, coming from South Africa, we're very like real people. So it was, I didn't have time to pretend. And that rubbed people the wrong way. Like it was literally like, there was rumors that I was a lesbian. There was rumors, like all these different rumors just started coming out. And it was just aimed at to kind of tarnish my character. And then this was how I was realizing, I was like, being an African, and it went back to the same thing. I was the only African in a very like prominently black community, which was Aboriginal people, but even the Aboriginal people didn't feel like I fit into their circle. Only my best friend Leona, who like she's still one of my best friends today, was she was also Aboriginal. She was the one who kind of resonated towards me. And I think the main thing was like, when you come from being, and you know, in an Australia and then you go back to South Africa and you come back, it's this whole thing of like, okay, where do I belong? Because when I'm in Australia, when I'm in South Africa, people are like, oh, you're the Australian girl. And then when I'm in South Africa, I mean, like, yeah, when I'm in South Africa, it's like, I mean, Australia, it's like, oh, you're the South African girl. Do you know what I mean? So then it was more about having to find that identity for myself and be like, okay, I'm a South African girl who was raised both in Australia and both in South Africa. But you go through so many waves of like identity searching, because like I said earlier, you don't want to be too white for the black kids or too black for the white kids. Do you know what I mean? So you try your best to kind of be in, but then I realized, especially when I grew up, I was like, I can't do that, because now what I'm actually doing, I'm killing the little bit of culture that my ancestors fought for. You know what I mean? I'm killing whatever character that got me here. Do you know what I mean? What Maya Angelou said, I am my ancestors' dream. So my ancestors would have never thought they'd be in an Australian country living the land of Caucasian life, you know what I mean? They never thought of that. So me living it now, I have to represent them where I am, you know what I mean? I'm like, we're still here, my G, you know? So, but yeah, that's kind of how it's been for me in the diaspora.
I love what you said about you are your ancestors' dream, that you're now the manifestation of all that has gone before you, which indicates a strong sense of culture and a strong sense of being something. And I think with your colleagues at school and what should we call them? Let's call them Bogans. I don't know. it's the uncouth, cultureless void of, I don't know, as Heinrich Goebbels said, when I hear the word culture, I reach for my revolver. You know, like, people just want to destroy it. They fear it. They don't understand. I will destroy what I can't understand. And I think that's the real Pauline Hanson attitude, is that, well, what's wrong with me? I'm simple and I don't want any other cultures. And that's just denial of the culture that you might have had already. If you're strong and confident in your own culture, as you said, as you came back from South Africa, you'd been through a lot. You've been back and forth. But you had this sense of identity now going back to South Africa. And you didn't need that other cultural approval. But I still think a lot of people in Australia need some sort of cultural approval, and they don't understand what their culture actually is. And I think that's really important for cultural development. But I'd let me go back to an emotional thing. When you went back to South Africa and you smelt it for the first time, or you felt it, or just can you talk about moments that made you feel, oh, this is home, and I feel my ancestors, or I smell my ancestors?
Honestly, as soon as you just touch down, it's the air. Like, there's just something in the air. Like, recently, I went to South Africa because my father was shot. And I remember, don't worry, everybody, he's so good. He's still alive, listeners. He's still good. He had to relearn how to walk, but he's good. But I went back, touched down, and literally just, I remember them opening, you know, we had to actually get off the plane. We didn't have one of those connectors. You know how sometimes they have the connectors from the airport into, but we didn't have the connector. So we got off through the steps. And I remember just going down the steps and I just felt this whiff of the wind. And it was just like, I'm home. And then the smell as well. And then I started seeing the transports, like the taxis that we have. And then I heard somebody speak my language and I could understand what they were saying, which for me, usually, like when you're in Australia and you find somebody who speaks your language or something similar to your language, it's a beautiful honor. You're like, oh my God, you're part of me too. Yay, let's do this. So it was like going when I touched down, and then literally was like eating a kota, which is a street food in South Africa. So I had kota, the bomb, ever, and then had even just like Black Label, you know, Hansa, the beers that we have back home, the fact that they come in the long stubby and not the small ones. We have the small ones, but you know, everybody usually buys the big stubby. And just seeing people outside, like seeing street vendors outside, and just seeing people just having community and just culture, the roads, like South Africa. I love Johannesburg because of the way Johannesburg's roads are, you know, the music. I never listen to the radio here. The music's trash. Apologies, it's trash, you know, because I'm not a pop person. So when I heard the radio and I could hear, like, it wasn't Afrobeats, it was Amapiano. No, it wasn't Amapiano at the time. It was Gqom, which is like another genre of South African deep house, basically. So I'm listening, I'm like, wait a minute, this is the real radio. Like, it's not like somebody put Bluetooth speaker and connected to their phone, which is what we do here, you know, you put your own music instead of listening to the radio. I was like, this is the radio. It's like just those different moments of being and feeling home. And I think that's one thing that I am honored to have, which is, you know, one thing that I'm very honored to have is that I have my culture. You know, I can learn how to, if I really, really want to, I can learn how to cook traditional food. You know, I can learn what are the ceremonies of marriage. And if I want to get married, what's the process for lobola, you know, or the dowry, everything. I can learn these things. And that for me is where my advantage comes in. And I think a lot of times, and I've had this with a lot of my friends in Australia, because I have African friends from, and actually have friends from different backgrounds in general, but I have a lot of African friends from different African countries. And some of my friends will tell me, like, oh, dude, like, I can hear my language, but I can't speak it. And I'm like, okay, cool. And I'm like, okay, who speaks your language at home? You know, because like my friends will come to me and they'd be like, oh, bro, like speak that click thing, you know, speak that click language. And then I'm like, lol. And then they'll see me talk to my brother or hear me talk to my mom on the phone and hear me speaking in my mother tongue. And then they just honor it and they love it. They're like, oh, bro, like I wish I could speak to my mom in that language. And I'm like, okay, who in your family speaks your mother tongue? Oh, my sisters speak it. My brother and sister speak it. I just don't speak it. Okay, when was the last time you spoke it? When I was like 4, when I first came here. I just listened to them and I was like, okay, cool. But think about that, right? When you're an African kid in Australia, when you're at home, you're an African. Like at home in your walls, your mom doesn't see you as another Australian child. Your mother sees you as an African child, or your uncle or whoever's taking care of you sees you as an African child. When you leave that door, it's when you become an Australian. Do you know what I mean? It's when you need to come in custom to the societal expectation of what, you know, slang is and music and every little thing of our Australian culture, right? If you don't have the foundation of your culture at home, when you go out of that door and the savages of the Australian culture comes at you, you won't be able to stand. Do you know what I mean? Because now you're trying to be, like I said, you don't want to be too black for the white kids, but you don't want to be too white for the black kids, you know? So, which is at home, you don't want to come home, because our African parents will teach you, they'll tell you, hey, we'll still eat our African food in our homes, you know? And I didn't even know that there's so much African culture in Australia, in people's houses, in people's families, you know what I mean? But now the problem comes when the youth don't know how to grow with it, you know? And I remember telling my friend, I was like, dude, listen, I didn't know how to speak Zulu like that. You know what I mean? I lived in a household where people were speaking Zulu amongst each other. They still spoke to me in Sotho, because South Africa, how we have different languages. I can speak to you in Sotho, you reply to me in Zulu. We're still having the same conversation, right? So they were speaking to me in Sotho and I was speaking to them in Zulu. No, they were speaking to me in Zulu and I was speaking to them in Sotho. So as time is progressing, I'm starting to pick up words. I'm starting to understand words. But now I'm no longer playing myself. You know, I'm actually starting to say the words. Of course, at first, I'm going to sound funny. You know, my brother didn't have the same blessing as me. He didn't go back to South Africa and stay for like that 3-year period. He stayed, ever since he's come to Australia, he stayed here. He's only visited South Africa once, but he's never, you know. So I remember when I started to speak to him in Sotho and speaking to him in Zulu, at first my nigga, you know, my friend was, my brother, was unable to actually articulate our language properly. You know, he was saying it in a funny way. So we would make fun of him, but But then as time progressed, we had to encourage him to continuously speak, you know. So the more we encouraged him to speak it, even past the jokes, even past him sounding funny, he started to get it. And then what did he start to do? He starts to watch, because I watch a lot of South African shows. So I watch things that are about my culture, you know what I mean? So now I'm teaching myself my culture. I'm taking it as my responsibility, because I don't want to get married, have children, and then have nothing to pass on to my children. You know what I mean? I want my kids to speak my language. I want my kids to know that mom's saying this, that means mom is saying this. Dad's saying this, that means dad is saying this. You know what I mean? So, yeah, it was more of like, I want my kids to know where mom comes from. You know, I want my kids to know that, oh, when you wear this dress, this is why. I ask my dad all the time. Like, I'll be having conversations with my dad, and I'll just be like, okay, pa. So, like, for example, one of my cousins got married recently. So I ask him, I'm like, so, Papa, what actually is the process of lebola? Like, and how do you guys scale the pricing? You know what I mean? Like, what makes somebody so worth so much, and what makes somebody worth so much? And he was telling me, he's like, okay, first you have to think about the fact that, has she had a child before? You know, has she been with another man before? All these different things, these are different ways. So me trying to find these conversations is helping me, because that makes me feel more South African. So when somebody comes to me and tries to attack me, or attack my culture, or attack me being an African woman, they can't touch me, because I have the background history. But that's the same thing that I say with everything in life. You need to take that accountability and responsibility on yourself. You know, we can't be mad like, oh, you know, I've grown here my whole life, it's not my fault that I don't know my language. You're lying. It's your fault. It is your fault. You know, you just didn't think it was that important. And then that's why we have our youth getting confused, not feeling like, you know, they know anything about themselves. You know, it's like, you know, when I'm at home, because I went to a women's conference, and it was mainly African mothers, and I went there for poetry, but then they asked me to speak because I was like the main youth representative there. So the conversation that was had, it was, the conversation was basically along the lines of, so we want our kids, like our children, to feel like they're African kids, but we don't want to also make them feel the pressure of being home and, you know, having this. Because, like, for example, some African families don't like sleepovers. So, like, a sleepover is like, what do you mean you're going to sleep over at someone's house? What for? Do you not have a bed here? Do you not have food here? Did you not see them long enough? You know what I mean? So, and then there's things like, oh, mom, I want to go to a party. What do you mean? You want to go there, do drugs, and be drinking? You know? So it's like, certain things in our culture, our parents would not allow them. You know what I mean? But then now the parents are feeling like, okay, but how do we make our kids not feel the pressure of they're missing out, or they don't actually have, you know, anything to speak about, you know, to us? Because now there becomes a gap between the parents and the kids, because now the parents are trying to teach their kids how to be African kids the way they were raised, instead of understanding that no, you're raising African kids in Australia. That's a completely different system. Don't use a system against a system. Use a system to help your kids. You know what I mean? I would tell people that to break a system, you use the same system. You use the same system to break that system, you know? So it was a thing of like, okay, how do we get our kids to feel like they can come and talk to us? Because, you know, Australia, one thing, especially in the Western world, mental health is like a major thing, you know. In our culture, it's like, if you have a problem, you'd probably talk to your auntie, you know, or you'd talk to your cousins or your something or something or something. But now we don't really have that big community where it's like, if you're upset, you can walk down the road and go to your auntie's house. Your auntie probably lives 20 minutes away. So now that breaks the ability for communication and for youth to be able to talk. And if the youth feels like their parents are not listening to them already, there's going to be a break in communication, you know? And now the parents are worried. They're like, oh, you know, our kids, they're starting to tell us they're depressed. We don't understand why they're saying they're depressed. This is why people starve. We don't deal with depression. What's depression? You know? But it's like, no, it's a breakdown in culture, you know? If the child knows that I'm in Australia, yes, mental health is something that's spoken about. It's okay to speak about it, but I can also go home and talk to my family about it. That's the foundational root. You know, let's talk to our kids. Let's teach them at home. Like I said, if you're telling your child you are an African in the house, and then when they leave the house, they don't know anything else. Now they're confused. You know, it's like sending an unprepared soldier to war. You know what I mean? They don't know anything. They don't have the standpoint of how to stand for themselves the way they should, you know?
I agree with you. I think culture is currency. Mm-hmm. Culture is a very strong currency that if we don't have it, then we're that much more impoverished in all aspects of society, not just, you know, culture, but also in economics, in health, and so on. It has a rolling on effect.
I think you know, like it does, and I think you see it a lot in the Aboriginal culture. You know, when you look at the Stolen Generation, and this is why people's narrative of get over it is very stupid, right? Because it's really stupid because, first of all, how do you tell people to get over something that was a trauma in their life? But anyway, when you look at the Stolen Generation, they stole a culture, you know? They stole, like, first of all, when you think about how the Aboriginal people used to live, right? There was many tribes that lived in one area. So in that one area, there were a lot of different languages, a lot of different principles of living and doing life, you know? So now, when you come to a point when you're like, okay, these people had their own roots of doing this. So you come with your big machines, right? And you wipe all these people out. First of all, when you see the people, you think they're probably all one, but they were all separated. Do you know, so they had their own cousins' cousins and their own cousins' cousins. And now you classify all these people as just one form of a people just because of their skin color looks the same. You know what I mean? So now what happens is, first we take the taking of the daughters, you know. So that's taking a form of, that's also taking generations away. Because who do children come from? From women. Do you know what I mean? And killing the men, that's taking away the stability of the culture, because men have always been like the social constructors of society. Even in indigenous situations, men have always—it's just patriarchy has always had its way of ruling, you know. So now you've taken the core, which is the men. You've taken the women, right? And now, not only that, these people don't have their languages, right? So that means they don't have a form of intimacy amongst each other, right? You've taken their food. So now their sustainability and what they feel is healthy for themselves mentally to keep going is no longer there. Now mentally they're hungry. Physically they're malnourished because that's not the food that they grew up eating. Do you get what I mean? And then you take their land, the place of their habitation. So now you've wiped out every single aspect of what makes a human being, you know? Because if you take away the culture, you take away the men, which are the gatekeepers, you take away the women, you know what I mean? You've literally killed the human spirit, because we as people, we need food. So you've taken their food away because they don't have their culture. They can't eat amongst each other. You've taken away their land. So where are they going to live? They're not going to live anywhere. You've taken away their language. That means you've taken away their relationship amongst each other. And then after that, you say, we're gonna put you in boxes. These boxes are called houses, and you need to live in this thing. And if you don't live in this box, you need to continue according to this system. Now you have to learn our language, right? After you learn our language, you have to give us your kids, and we want your kids to be the ones to give our kids kids. So we're wiping you out completely. You're out of the system. Now, what ends up happening is a people are lost. That's why I've seen an Aboriginal woman cry, and I can feel it like five generations back, because it's a deep sorrow. You know what I mean? It's a deep sorrow. It's a pain that's like, it's rooted so deeply, because once you've taken somebody's culture away from them, you've taken their way of living. So you've taken their direction. You've taken their future. You know what I mean? Because with us, we use our traditions, especially Indigenous people, we use our traditions to help us lead forward as to where we're supposed to go ahead. You know, using your culture and your past and your history helps you to see how we're going to manifest things into the future. But when you don't have your history, how are you going to go forward? Because now you don't have anything that's of substance that's going to take you forward. And now it's like, oh yeah, we've put you in boxes and we've given you resources. Stop crying. Here's some liquor for your sorrows. Here's some drugs as well while you're at it. You know what I mean? So now it's like, oh, I'm not only destroying you character-wise, I'm not only destroying you economically, I'm not destroying your family, I'm not only just destroying you emotionally, I'm even giving you tools to self-destruct. And then afterwards, I'm going to ask you, why are you not okay? Why are you crying? Stop crying. You're making noise. You're disturbing me from living in your land and eating your resources for free. Stop. I don't want to hear you cry anymore. What is that?
That was President Fonso Ntupi. No, I know what you mean. Like, I remember when Adam Goods did the victory dance after kicking a goal. I thought, wow, that's great. You know, here's an echo of the past. This is, and I thought, oh, fantastic. And unfortunately, other people, though, got angry about it, because I think when the dominant culture is challenged in any way, it just bites back and destroys things. But look, these are the issues we'll be dealing with in Monrovia. So thanks so much for listening to this podcast. Yeah, it's a podcast. I've decided it's a podcast, isn't it? Yeah. And just one final word from Ponzo, who's going to answer all your problems.
Stop stealing people's
coffee. That's good advice. It's really good advice. Thank you, Ponzo.